So our next speaker is going to focus in on the water issues. He's Dr. Steven Penengroff. Dr. Penengroff is Executive Director and Senior Scientist at the Community Science Institute and Technical Director of the Institute's NYSEOH Certified Water Testing Laboratory and has consulted at several Superfund toxic waste sites. He is the author of a textbook for non-specialist essentials of toxic chemical risk, science, and society, and he has spoken and consulted widely on water testing near hydrocracking sites. The title of Steven's talk is How to Monitor Groundwater and Surface Water for Contamination. Before I turn it over, I just want to remind you, if you have questions, please pass them out to the side, because we're going to give you the chance to have those questions asked for you.
Well, I'd like to say it's a great honor to be here to give this talk to the company of distinguished colleagues. I would like to thank the organizers. I'm sorry, the mic. I have to use a mic. Where's the mic? Is this the mic?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Just stand it up there. You should. The organizers, Mary and Donna and David and Matt, thank you very much for pulling this all together and inviting four people from Ithaca to come up and talk to you. The goal of my talk is monitoring water in order to detect contamination. We've heard a lot about contamination. What I'm going to talk about is how to detect it, the contamination from shale gas waste. And the approach that I'm going to talk about is partnerships between a certified lab, namely ours, although it could be any certified lab, and volunteers from the community. So I'm the generalist, okay? I'm not a specialist, except perhaps in the world of certified labs. So I'm going to talk about monitoring for gas flow impacts and the use of signature chemicals to do that. Am I still okay with the mic?
A little bit.
Speak up. Mic up.
Get closer to the mic.
Get closer to the mic. I love to walk around, but obviously I'm not going to.
You can do that.
I have a solution for you.
Oh, here you go.
Cool. Yeah. Sure.
Does this work?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Okay. I bet you wish you would. Okay, let us first talk a little bit about the Community Science Institute. I'm the director of a small nonprofit. Very brief background. Founded in 2000, our mission is to empower citizens to become stewards of their local environment. And we do that by inviting them to participate in monitoring programs, water monitoring programs. Operate a certified laboratory. We have a newly added mapping capability. Small staff, 2 full-time, 4 part-time, 1 student intern, sources of support, mostly local governments, local foundations, our fee-for-service testing, Cornell University contributes, and individual donors, and our budget was a whopping $180,000 last year. So what we do is monitor water quality now in the Cayuga Lake watershed. And to do that, we partner with 7 autonomous groups of volunteers. Each group is responsible for sampling a specific set of fixed locations, such as locations along a stream. Up to 5 times a year, base flow and stormwater conditions, volunteers transport samples to our lab, and our analyses focus mostly on agricultural pollution and urban and suburban issues such as bacteria, sediment, nutrients, and salt. Groundwater salt is obviously an issue. The certified data items that we produce in our lab from the samples that volunteers collect is archived in an open online database. We currently have about 20,000 certified data items and are adding about 5,000 new data items per year. It works out to about $1 million worth of data if you cost it out. So we're very proud of our database. Go to www.communityscience.org, click on database, and you can see our data. Oops, wrong direction, sorry. So this is the Cayuga Lake watershed. Land use map, brown is basically agriculture, green is basically forest. The red lines encompass the monitoring sets. Each area delineated by red lines is monitored by a specific volunteer group. And we can give you the monitoring sites. These, the red sites are the sites where our volunteers collect water. So we cover roughly two-thirds of the Cayuga Lake watershed. At this point, over 100 locations. This is a close-up of a land use map. The yellow is urban and suburban development, but this just gives you a somewhat better idea of our monitoring density, the density of monitoring locations. So that's what we do, and that's the model that I'm going to talk about using to try to detect contamination from frack water. So now let's talk about risks to water. You've heard a lot about the chemicals. The shale gas industry, as we know, poses risks to water. There are some things that are known about flowback. It's a source of toxic and radioactive chemicals, as you've heard. The waste actually qualifies as hazardous waste, even though it's exempted from being treated as hazardous waste. A bill was just introduced through the New York State Legislature to treat flowback as hazardous waste. And if it is treated as hazardous waste, the significance of that is that it then has to be tracked. There are manifests, and it has to be tracked according to federal law under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA. So reclassifying or removing the exemption from shale gas waste as hazardous waste would be huge in terms of safety. What we don't know about gas well waste is, as Tom and Adam pointed out, is the specific chemicals from each well, the actual toxicity of the waste, and the probability or the risk of contaminating water or air for that matter. We do know how to assess risk. It's not like we don't know, we do know. A process for assessing risk from hazardous chemicals was created by the EPA about 20 years ago. EPA framework for ecological risk assessment, and that conceptual framework can also be applied to human health. It's the same concepts. Risk assessment begins with exposure assessment, and that's what I'm going to focus on is exposure. So this is a cartoon of ecological risk assessment. I just want to point out that characterization of exposure and characterization of effects are the two pillars of risk assessment. And what you've heard in two other talks is the characterization of toxicity or toxic effects. I'm going to talk more about exposure. The risk is a composite function of exposure and toxicity. And any toxic chemical poses a risk if it gets into the environment, okay, water, soil, air, such that humans or other species may come in contact with it. But the conventional definition is that even a highly toxic chemical does not pose any risk if there's no exposure to it. Okay. So just make that clear. So let's think about some of the ways that flowback can get into surface water. Surface water and groundwater. Let's talk about surface water first. Transport of fracking chemicals and storage on the drill pad. You can have truck accidents, leaks from storage containers. And then you can have spills on the drill pad and leaks from valves, which malfunction. If you store the flowback in open pits, you can have off gases, such as radon or VOCs, volatile organic compounds, leaks through tears in the plastic liners, breach of the pit walls when it rains a lot, the contents can overflow. There can be truck accidents. Another way that chemicals can get into the environment is inadequate screening, and I think Tom talked about that. Inadequate screening based on an outdated list of chemicals that are used to used to equip wastewater treatment plants to treat industrial waste. It's called the priority pollutant list. There are 126 chemicals on that list, and as Tom and Adam pointed out, there's something like 600 plus chemicals that are known to be involved in hydraulic fracturing in one way or the other. So clearly that priority pollutant list is not adequate for screening gas well waste that goes into wastewater treatment plants. And then there's bioaccumulation and biomagnification. When chemicals get into the food web, they can become biomagnified as they go up the food chains. So what about groundwater? Well, obviously there could be faulty cement casing around well holes, fracture patterns underground that were anticipated, and then abandoned gas wells that might present conduits for fracturing fluid, and of course earthquakes, even though there's not a lot of seismic activity in upstate New York. So there hasn't been any exposure assessment for hydrofracking so far, as Adam pointed out so eloquently. The literature is pretty silent on that. But there have been reports of accidents in Pennsylvania and other states, so that we know that exposure of water can occur and does occur by multiple pathways. So if we know the probability of exposure, that would be the first step in managing risk. But if we don't have an exposure assessment, there's a huge scientific uncertainty about the risk. We have no way of knowing what the risk actually is without knowing the exposure as well as the toxicity. The greater the scientific uncertainty, the more risk management decisions are dominated by economic and worldview issues and not by science. And that, I think, is the situation we find ourselves in now. I'm not sure you can read that very well. Apologize for the slide. This is scientific uncertainty on the x-axis. This is state and risk management decisions on the y-axis. So with low scientific uncertainty and low decision stakes, science dominates. But as you move to high scientific uncertainty and large decision stakes, worldview and economics dominate in risk management decisions, and that is, I think, pretty much where we're at now with hydraulic fracturing. So how might exposure be assessed? So there are a couple of ways, and you can probably think of a lot of ways, but there are two ways right off the bat. One of them is that gas companies could add tracer dyes to their fracking fluid. Example would be a fluorescent dye like rhodamine. Or citizens could monitor signature chemicals that are associated with shale gas waste and also monitor biological indicators of stream health. Another way to do it. So let's look at the feasibility of these two exposure assessment strategies. Tracer dyes. Well, actually, that would be great. I mean, that's potentially the most effective way to monitor exposure. But gas companies would need to agree to add tracer dyes voluntarily, or New York State would need to mandate tracer dyes. They might do that, but I personally don't care to wait too long. The other way is engaging citizens in monitoring water quality. And you can do that because shale gas waste, although we don't know the individual chemicals, it does have a broad chemical signature that we can detect. And you can detect it at dilutions up to 100 to 1,000 fold. And also there are aquatic organisms that can be harmed by low levels of toxic chemicals that you can monitor. So even in the absence of chemical evidence, you might be able to obtain biological evidence of contamination. So here's the chemical signature. On the left here, brine, acid, metals, detergents, bulk organic chemicals, individual organic chemicals, natural gas or methane, and then naturally occurring radioactive materials. So what I've listed on the right are the standard certified tests that can be used to detect each one of these classes. So the idea of a chemical signature is to do as many chemical analyses as necessary to obtain a signature, but as few as possible in order to keep the costs down. So this is this is a compromise. And you need to perform a pre-drilling baseline working with a certified lab. The window for the baseline is actually about 5 to 6 years before drilling starts. Okay. A lot of people are surprised to hear me say that because there, the word on the street basically is that it's 6 months or something like that. But it isn't, because 5 to 6 years is consistent with state monitoring programs under the Clean Water Act. The state monitors lakes and streams every 5 to 6 years in New York State and other states as well. So this 5 to 6 years of water not changing its quality except as a result of human impacts is accepted. That's the way monitoring is done under the Clean Water Act. The chemical signature should be repeated within 6 months after the gas well is completed. And if you suspect contamination, of course, you should try to get expert corroboration, maybe more tests, maybe an expert opinion. And then the next step would be to pursue testing of all possible contaminants. So if you get a positive chemical signature, then I think the next step would be to go to the gas company and say, we've got a problem, and would you pay, please, for a comprehensive set of tests and a health risk assessment. Now I see some people looking and saying, oh, they're never going to do that. Okay. But maybe they won't. But if 100 people ask them, and if 100 people go to the DEC, if it becomes an issue of public policy, things could change. I mean, they may have to do that. If you can demonstrate the likelihood of health impacts, then, of course, legal advice as appropriate. So streams and lakes are a different animal than groundwater. Most streams and lakes are part of the environmental commons. It's not private property like a private drinking water well. Streams and lakes are ecosystems, and they're affected by activities that occur throughout the watershed, not just at a single point. And so monitoring needs to occur at multiple locations. But this is the Community Science Institute's approach to monitoring streams, where the volunteers perform field tests with certified lab support. And the trained volunteers monitor multiple stream locations, each draining a few square miles, and they perform what I call red flag tests. These are basically the same tests that the robot monitors that have been set up by the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, the SRBC, also test for. They test for temperature, pH, dissolved oxygen, conductivity, and turbidity. And we test for temperature, pH, dissolved oxygen, conductivity, and total hardness. So it's different. The reason we test for total hardness is that a turbidity meter costs about $1,000, and we can't really afford that on our budget. So the volunteers are supported by our certified lab. We give them calibration standards. We split samples with them. We review their data. And if the data are good enough, then we post the data on our website. But the data have to meet certain criteria before we'll post it on our website. In addition to the red flag monitoring, you need a chemical signature, a more comprehensive test of chemicals, something like I showed you with groundwater, but you don't have to do all the same tests as you do with groundwater because, for example, the gases, VOCs, or the volatile organic compounds, and the methane are gases that are probably going to escape fairly rapidly from flowing streams, so you can probably save the expense of testing for those. But you do want to test for things like metals, like barium and strontium. Those are good indicators. You want to test for NORM, the naturally occurring radioactive materials, and chemical oxygen demand, and several others that you also use in testing groundwater. Biological indicators of stream health are aquatic insects. Has anybody heard of BMI? Mm-hmm. You know BMI? Benthic macroinvertebrates. These are aquatic insects. It's a standard process for evaluating ecosystem health, stream ecosystem health, used extensively by the DEC. And the changes in the community structure of benthic macroinvertebrates can reveal long-term low-level contamination that you might miss if you just analyze the chemistry. This is our first gas well monitoring group, the first group that's devoted exclusively to monitoring for gas well contamination, the Cuyuna Catatonic Water Watch in Tioga County. They are monitoring about 25 locations in the Cuyuna Creek watershed and the Catatonic Creek watershed. They are monitoring for those five red flag parameters once a month. There's mailing their data sheets to us. I'm reviewing the data sheets, and we are accumulating data. We are accumulating baseline data. So I think that baseline data, transparent baseline data, is very important. It's important to have a public understanding of water quality before hydrofracking begins. So we plan to organize baseline stream monitoring partnerships in counties that are going to be on the front line of gas well drilling, that is Chenango, Broome, and Chemung counties, in addition to Tioga counties. So, and I'm also hoping that private homeowners will share their groundwater data. We're doing a number of, we're analyzing groundwater, private drinking water wells for a number of property owners across the southern tier. Other labs are doing the same. If homeowners share their private well data, that's groundwater data. That's a really rich source of groundwater data. Obviously, the data would have to be shared publicly in an anonymous format. I'm not talking about people saying, I live here and this is my water quality. We wouldn't do that. I think that's the end. Thank you very much.